All right, our next matter is Breathauer versus Livorne. And we have two parties represented on the appellee side. How are you planning to divide your time, or are you dividing your time?
I agree with all.
You're speaking for both? Okay, Mr. Spray, thank
That's
you.
Correct.
Yes, all right, thank you very much. All right. Again, this is the matter of Breathauer versus Livorne. Mr. Hazard?
Good morning.
My name is James Hazard. I represent Dustin Livorne, who is a special administrator of the state of Human. We have two appeals consolidated for purposes of consideration of the court. I am only going to address case 87, which regards to the ruling on holographic order. So, this matter, we support the court based on the trial court, the district court determining that the court of holographic will is not valid, is not probate. The court, in making that decision, did not consider extrinsic evidence as far as the So, in my brief, I addressed the argument for the use of extrinsic evidence, but I didn't address that here this morning. I don't think that extrinsic evidence makes a statement very, very clear. I don't think that we need extrinsic evidence in order to go into holographic. Holographic will in this case is very short, contains two sentences. I, Brian Peterman, want all my property, all the Dustin and Warren, hereby and change my will. District Court determined that the holographic will failed to show sufficient testamentary and donated. The court also specifically through the second sentence, which stated, I hereby and change my will, as expressing Tiedemann's intent to create a new will at future. Now, the law is really pretty clear that a court in construing a will must ascertain and effectuate the testator. In so doing, it must examine the will in its entirety, consider and liberally interpret every provision in the will, or you generally accept the literal and grammatical meaning of words used in the maker of the words used. And that's per the usual state of consent. The court found that there wasn't sufficient donor or testamentary intent, and it was expression create the will in the future. The court in its order quoted extensively and in the rights to rely primarily on the Common Health case, which is a 2002 New Jersey case. That case really focuses the definition of material provisions on holographic will. The court stated the most significant material provisions are a restriction of the property and those who are receiving. Liberally construed, holographic will before the court, those provisions are clear. Property is described as all my property, all to Dustin Livorne. Not be more specific.
But we don't know what that property is from this, do
well,
we?
Well, we don't know what that property is, but that's not uncommon in a will at all. When it says all my property, the residuary clause in most every will says all of my property, not specific to rights and goals. So not having a specific itemization policy is not uncommon, not unusual, nor is it anything that's required by holographic will statute. All you need is an identification of properties sufficient to allow the court or the person to administer that property, and that's clearly present.
And you disagree with the court's determination that intend to change my will the court found was a future intent, and your argument in your brief is that the word hereby makes it present, right?
I think it absolutely does. I think it explicitly contradicts the judge's finding.
If we were to determine that, I mean, clearly there's a disagreement and potential ambiguity, would you say that's a patent ambiguity, which means we cannot go outside the words of the document? Or do you think that the law that applies with regard to patent ambiguity only applies when trying to interpret the application of the words instrument insofar as who gets what, for example.
Typically, that is not, that provision would not be one that I would expect that the courts, according to precedent, to say, yes, we're going to look through.
If there is case law, that the whole idea of testamentary intent has been applied in terms of, is this instrument or document a will? And it's also been applied once a will has been admitted to probate to determine what the intent of the testator was in disposing of the property, right? It's been reviewed in two different capacities that way. And that would be applicable in both situations then?
My reading of this was it was not necessarily a passive. This is such an odd situation. But if you look at the cases that talk about future intent, they're really quite clear. They are either instructions to a bank or to an attorney to say, I want to change my will, please prepare this. Or they are a note to a family member or a devotee saying, changing my will, to do that. This is clearly not.
If somebody just, if your client had walked in to file this will and there was no other information about where it came from or any of the circumstances surrounding it, that's how we have to look at this, right? Because we can't get to the extrinsic evidence unless there's a legal basis for us to do that. What is your best argument that we can get to the extrinsic evidence?
My best argument, I think, is
right, I understand that, but if we're not on the same page with that, how do we get to the extrinsic evidence?
Well, the court in several cases, the Dimmitt case, several other cases, have said things like, you can consider attendant circumstances. Now, it doesn't go on to define what those are, and they really don't give you much guidance as to what those are, but the court itself has looked at external circumstances. Even when they say they're not, the Foxley case that Appleby cited, the court in that case even says, we must remember both the original and the copy of the will were found in the den of Foxley's home, and an argument can be made that she is simply making notes on it. So even when the court kind of says they're not considering extrinsic evidence, they really are. We have a document here that provided to Mr. Tiedemann's attorney. A holographic will is really kind of a real-world thing. It's intended for people who either don't have access to an attorney or don't have the sophistication to go to an attorney, but the legislature has determined they should have the right to advise their property on. Mr. Tiedemann is not an attorney. If I'm going to make notes of myself or I'm thinking I want to do a will in the future. I don't say, I, James Hazard, want my property to go to X. I hereby intend to make a new will in the future. That's not how lay people talk. I don't think it's even how lawyers talk. And I think when we read this in its entirety, and use a practical, real-world approach to it, I don't see how you can interpret it as anything other than him saying, I want my property to go to Dustin LeBlanc. By this document, by these very words, I intend to accomplish it. I think that's the only reasonable interpretation.
But isn't the factual scenario that you just gave a little different than what you have here? He was in his attorney's office when he writes this thing out, if I recall the facts correctly. And then he lived for a fairly significant period thereafter, and he had his attorney's advice. Well, come back and see me, and we'll get this taken care of.
I think the inference from that is he didn't do that because he believed he had solved the problem by making the holographic will. Yeah, that's really kind of outside of the record, but I'm saying normal people don't talk like this if they don't believe they're making the will. That's not the way they talk when they.
Thank you. Good morning. Can I ask initially, are you still preserving an issue related to the supersedia since that's been paid?
No, I think the courts handled that. I think the court had authority to handle jurisdictions to the best of the court.
And are you speaking on behalf of Ms. Clark as well? Because there, you didn't raise it in your brief, but I saw that Ms. Clark was challenging this court's decision on that. I want to know if you're continuing to...
I guess we included that in case this went on to the Supreme Court. If we're not, we're fine with our argument.
All right. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Time's already started. Oh, no, she started. Okay. I'll be sure where we're at. My name is J.L. Spray. I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Sue Ann Brethauser, as sorted out here, Mr. Dale Dahlin sitting as well with me as counsel, Ms. Jody Clark, another appellee in this case. I want to start by just putting a little bit of context here. One of the most ancient and sacred things that we do in society is we put the full force of the government behind somebody's will, and we sort out that through a probate process where those assets are going to go. So, as you know, person doesn't have a will, the state takes it upon itself to determine where the property goes. If a person follows certain rules, they get to have the full force of the state behind their wishes. The sheriff will go out and collect the property, the judge will order distribution, and the state will take control. So that's the context that we're in here. The governmental act of probate. Now, the access to the probate court for a testamentary estate is through a holographic will in this case. And it's not what normal people do in the standard. It's a standard set by the legislature as a matter of policy. It's out of an intestate setting. If you do certain things, of course, this particular document, all scrap paper, there's not much to it, 25 words, or 20 words, about 25% of which, the 5 words make names. So, probably about really 15 substantive words in this bill, putative bill. But this document, folks in court's jurisdiction, and the court has now said that there's just not enough testamentary intent. So, parsing out the issues raised this morning, I think the first one is, are we looking for latent ambiguity, et cetera? My position is not that matters, because as Judge Bishop indicated, there's really two inquiries here. First, is there enough testamentary intent to make this a will? That's what our after that, you go around looking for testamentary intent and what the bill means or says or does. And there are really two different approaches to how you legally analyze that. So with regard to whether there's testamentary intent or not, if you find it then, do you then not? Call it latent, patent, whatever you want to call it. Then there's not a clear testamentary intent, and therefore you can't have a will. So the most simplest form of the argument is this. If you find that it's not clear from the four corners of this document what this decedent is saying, he has testamentary intent, it's a 43-year-old man. If it's not clear what he's doing here, you find there's some ambiguity, or you have to gap fill with some words. We heard a lot of words from the appellant this morning. He wants you to say that this property should go to Dustin Lamore. Did you hear that? That this was a device, that it donative intent. Those words aren't here. In fact, the most solemn thing about a will is it says at the top, this is my will, last will and testament, will, anything that would have indicated this was his will, a reference to a will, second sentence, if you find a period there, I have trouble finding it. But in the second sentence says, I intend, third intent, to make a will. My intention is to make a will. That's
it says, change my will.
I'm sorry, change my will. But think about this. If, in fact, he's changing an existing will, then what he's intending to do is create a codicil, not use this document as a will. So if we incorporate some other document into this will to fully interpret it, have a will before he died. Or does this mean I intend to make a codicil to my will in the future, or do I intend to make a new will? Some act in the future. Clearly, it's a future act. And I think the discussion of present act versus future act, obviously you're going to have to look at this document and come to your own conclusion. But it is ambiguous. And if it is ambiguous, then you can't find clear testamentary intent out of the document. So the issue of whether there's a verb or not, that's a gap fill that has to occur. You would have to fill in the words in order to find that there's a verb in those two sentences. You would have to insert the word devise, if, give. But think about this. What if this will were interpreted as say, all property to Dustin LaVorne for life? Insert those words. Hold it around. All property to Dustin LaVorne to farm. Whole different outcome. All property to Dustin LaVorne to sell. Whole different outcome. So when you start filling gaps, as the court said in Boxley, it's a slippery slope. Where do you stop? How much gap filling are you going to do for this evening or turn this into a will? And because there are choices, it's not clear. And there's not clear testamentary intent in the will fails. So, present meaning of the words, future meaning of the words. I want to lose weight. I plan to lose weight. I hope in the future I intend to lose weight. I'm not standing here losing any weight. On my track record, I probably won't lose weight. But it's the same thing. I can say I, in the present, I intend to do something in the future. Unless that word even in there, I intend or intend to make movement.
So, Mr. Spray, you rely on the Foxley case that Mr. Hazard referred to, and in that case it is a little puzzling that the Supreme Court did appear to look at extrinsic evidence to evaluate whether or not that was a valid codicil, holographic codicil, right? So did they implicitly permit, without going through the discussion of latent versus patent ambiguity, did they implicitly appear to allow consideration of extrinsic evidence?
I think the distinction is this, because that document was a mixed typewritten and handwritten document presented in that fashion. And because there were issues that do permit extrinsic evidence, such as, was there a signature? So, for instance, Judge Jacobson, he took extrinsic evidence, I think properly so, to determine that one of the issues for him, which was the deceased's handwriting. So, for the limited purpose, he did say that. For that limited purpose, he looked at extrinsic evidence. He didn't look at any extrinsic evidence with four corners to determine testamentary intent. That is the only issue here, is testamentary intent. I think to go outside of this document, start down the slippery slope, the gap, put yourselves in the testator's shoes with what he really meant to say here.
There are other jurisdictions that look at, when you're trying to decide whether a document is a will, that you may be able to look at extrinsic evidence, not as to what it means in the will in terms of donative intent, but whether the testamentary intent was there. There are a number of jurisdictions that do that. Are you aware of any cases in Nebraska that specifically address whether you can consider the extrinsic evidence other than what Foxley seems to implicitly do?
Well, I think the most cases Judge Jameson cited is there. I think Foxley actually said that too. My recollection, yes, here it is. But Foxley, one of the things it said, probably dicta, but it said you don't have to look to the legislature for what testamentary intent means. And look at what kind of things the legislature requires to find. It's not really a standard for testamentary intent. But if that's what you're charged with doing, I think you're limited to looking at the document. Four corners, which our court has clearly said, you've got to look at four corners to determine testamentary intent, and that applies, in my opinion, to both testamentary intent as to making a will, but also testamentary intent as what I mean by these words and what I call my property. So I think the Foxley case is the most instructive on the subject matter.
Does the fact that Judge Jacobson did receive Exhibit 1, the affidavit of Attorney Timmer, with the exclusion of three of the provisions, and does not specifically limit that the use of that affidavit was to determine whether the handwriting...
I think it would have been better order to consider instead of the limited purpose of determining his handwriting issue.
but he didn't.
I think it's very implied that he was doing. I also believe that he was very clear that he wasn't going to look at extrinsic evidence determining the core issue of testimony that might be properly doing. He relied on the council decision, but I think Fox is clear guidance on it.
If the court had permitted the extrinsic evidence, there would have been evidence that what this decedent wished to do was to leave his estate to his nephew.
I mean, there's evidence that this Timmer meeting never even, the lawyer never even happened. So yeah, there's lots of extrinsic evidence we could go through, and lots of issues we could try. But at the core is whether there's enough in these four corners to make a clear statement of testimony.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Is there some rebuttal time? All right, Mr. Hazard.
Well, very quickly, Your Honor. I don't know what Mr. Spray is talking about. There was evidence that the meeting didn't occur at all. Mr. Spray, in his argument, just like Judge Jason, decided to ignore the words hereby by this document, the very words. Mr. Spray also says, well, he could have said, given it's my property, the Justin was on the farm, modifiers could be added to anything, but the fact that he even could have added modifiers to what a polygraph will not make it invalid or improper as it presently exists. Those are not required by the statute of drafting wills. And the judge also said, well, it doesn't say I revoke other wills. That's not a requirement of the statute or the case law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The matter is submitted. Thank you all. We are adjourned.